It is Friday, June 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, violence erupts in Pakistan. The United Nations says cholera rates are soaring in Yemen. And blood backpacks can save lives in remote areas. It's all ahead. Friday has been a violent day in Pakistan. I spoke with reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about continuing violence that has claimed lives around the country.
There have been two attacks. The first attack happened, it was a suicide car bombing, and it happened in southwestern Pakistani city of Quetta, where apparently the target was senior police officers, because that powerful blast killed at least 13 people and wounded 20 others. And most of the victims are police personnel. And while authorities were still investigating and the Pakistani media was showing live pictures of this devastating bomb explosion, that in northwestern Pakistan, it's a tribal region near the border with Afghanistan, where two back-to-back bombs exploded in a busy market in the afternoon. There was a first low-intensity blast that attracted the attention of the people who were busy doing shopping, and everybody rushed to the scene, and that is when a massive bomb was detonated. It's not clear whether it was a suicide blast or it was a time device, and that has, as of this moment, officially killed at least 25 people and more than 100 have been wounded. And these, most of the victims are minority Shiite Muslims.
So the fact that the victims were Shiite, what would be the significance of that?
Well, we don't have any claims of responsibility for the latest attacks. But what we know, just a little while ago, Islamic State, on its global mouthpiece, Amaq News Agency, issued a statement claiming the suicide bombing in the southwestern city of Quetta was carried out by its people, its fighters. We don't have any claims of responsibility for the attacks in Parachanar near the Afghan border, in which 25 people have been killed. But this previous such attack was claimed by Islamic State because that group has been targeting Shiite Muslims in Pakistan. So, as I said, it is so far we have not received any statement from the Islamic State or any other militant group, but Shiites have been targeted by Sunni militant groups in Pakistan.
Also, the timing of this, I believe it's coming up to Eid, the end of Ramadan. Is there perhaps some significance to do with that?
Well, obviously, because of the market today and for the next 2 days are usually will be crowded. And I think that's why these attackers use this occasion to cause maximum casualties. But it is very unfortunate that at a time when Pakistanis were preparing, families were preparing and busy buying stuff for the Eid festival, which is due on Monday, that these major attacks have happened. But in the meantime, just half an hour ago, in the southwestern port city of Karachi, we have two incidents of drive-by shootings where unknown gunmen riding motorcycles, and in one incident, they were riding a car, that they attacked police personnel in Karachi and have killed four police officers. So officials, as of this moment, from their statements, are suggesting that all these attacks are linked.
But because of a number of attacks, Ayaz, I mean, have Pakistani authorities issued any kind of warnings to the population about, you know, to be careful because there could be rising terrorist incidents?
Yes, it is. The Prime Minister's office has issued a statement in which Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has been quoted as instructing authorities to beef up security all around the country, because it clearly indicates that things could be really serious for Pakistanis as they prepare to celebrate the Eid festival. So security has already been tight in Pakistan, as we know that there have been off and on attacks carried out by either Pakistani Taliban militants or the Islamic State loyalists. But these attacks, especially that have occurred today, suggests that there could be more such incidents, and that is why Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif himself has issued these instructions that authorities need to beef up security.
That's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, lots of people talking about actor Johnny Depp, but for all the wrong reasons. He was in the Glastonbury Music Festival in the United Kingdom, introducing one of his films during a screening. And he said, "How long has it been since an actor assassinated the president? It's been a while, and maybe it's time."
Oh.
So obviously, a threat against the president is not something you ever want to hear from anyone, but particularly from someone in a public place, in a public role like Johnny Depp. It certainly went across the internet, lots of people talking about it. And outrage on social media, really across the aisle, it doesn't matter where you are politically, people saying they should not have said this. It was some kind of joke he was trying to make that just did not work. And so people saying that it was a poor move on his part, to say the least.
Yeah, he probably was, we should say for people in other countries, hinting at, you know, the Lincoln assassination,
right,
which happened down the street here at Ford's Theater, and John Wilkes Booth.
Right, who was an actor.
Who was an actor.
Shot President Lincoln. So that's the joke, I guess, behind this, or the historical context for this. But so the outrage spreading across social media, calls to boycott Depp's movies. One report that I saw that said Secret Service has been made aware of his comments. Of course, they investigate any credible threats against the president. So we'll see if Johnny Depp will face any ramifications from that. But people saying, too, that there's a bit of a double standard here, because they're looking back to Ted Nugent, the musician who back in the fall of last year called for President Obama and Hillary Clinton to be shot.
Yeah.
And people saying that he didn't face any ramifications for that. So why should Johnny Depp get that criticism? But really just an unfortunate incident, but one that is resonating across social media today. The other story we're looking at is a new initiative from Facebook in the United Kingdom to fight extremism and hate speech online. It's the Online Civil Courage Initiative, and it's going to bring funding and resources to different agencies within the UK to tackle hate speech on Facebook. They've already launched this program in France and Germany, and it looks like they're going to be rolling it out to more and more places throughout the world, particularly in the European Union, where there's been a big crackdown on hate speech and extremism online. So they're rolling this out. COO of Facebook, Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg, said there is no place for hate or violence on Facebook. So that is part of this initiative that they're rolling out. We talked about on the show previously how some of the world leaders in Europe, UK Prime Minister Theresa May, French President Emmanuel Macron, have come out and called for social networks to actually pay and be fined for the content that they're finding on social media as far as extremism. So this is a way for them to tackle that, maybe avoid some of those fines, work with these governments. And again, I think we're going to see more and more of this going on, not just in Europe, but throughout the world, as social media continues to be a place where people go, and unfortunately, extremists and terrorists go to try to recruit people and spread some of these views. So more to follow on that. We'll also see if other social networks jump on board. Right now, Facebook has been the one really spearheading a lot of these things. We haven't heard much from Twitter or any other networks.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you whether Twitter said anything about
that. Yeah, they've said committed to fighting hate speech. They've removed accounts, hate speech accounts from online. But right now, Facebook is putting a lot of the money behind it. And it makes sense, because Facebook has nearly 2 billion worldwide monthly active users. So that is the worldwide social network right now.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. President Trump will sign a bill that facilitates the firing of federal Veterans Affairs workers accused of wrongdoing. President Trump says the friendship between the leader of the Russia probe and fired FBI director is very bothersome. A poll says few voters in Texas think education spending is too high, and London police may file manslaughter charges after the apartment fire. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
By now, you've probably heard about the 2016 discovery of Planet 9, a huge planet-like object that may be orbiting the sun far off in the outer reaches of the solar system. now, a pair of planetary scientists from the University of Arizona in Tucson have found evidence of yet another planet-sized object orbiting in deep space. Like Planet 9, this new planetary object has not been directly spotted, but was noticed due to the orbital behavior of some Kuiper Belt objects. The University of Arizona scientists say their studies indicate their new discovery may have a mass that's somewhere between that of Earth and Mars and might be located about 15 billion miles from the Sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, in Britain, communities are calling on authorities to do more to tackle violence by right-wing extremists. The United Nations Children's Fund warns cholera cases and deaths in war-torn Yemen continue to mount and could reach 300,000 by the end of August. UNICEF puts the current number of suspected cases at nearly 200,000, including more than 1,200 deaths, with a quarter of those being children. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF says containing the cholera outbreak in Yemen is extremely difficult. It says the health system is near total collapse. Water and sanitation systems are in disrepair. And the people who are meant to care for patients, collect the garbage, and maintain vital systems have not been paid for 6 months. The UNICEF representative in Yemen, Merichel Relano, says despite the obstacles, aid agencies are making progress in reducing cholera cases and deaths in some parts of the country. Speaking from Sana'a, she says UNICEF and partners are meeting with some success in preventing the spread of the disease in places where they have provided families and communities with a package of intervention. She tells VOA the package includes household water purification.
A team of people, they go house by house and they check the water sources that the family is using. They chlorinate the water tanks if they have a water tank. And then they are informed about the ways to avoid cholera by providing good hygiene in the family, hand washing with soap, how to handle the food, and how to handle a family member that is sick with cholera or with diarrhea.
Relano says it is important to know how to care for a patient because cholera is sometimes transmitted by the fluids of a sick person. Cholera, which is caused by contaminated food and water, is easily treated if caught quickly. However, it can kill in a matter of hours if left untreated. The UNICEF representative says cholera cases are going down in 77 of the country's 333 districts where aid agencies have introduced the life-saving package of integrated measures. This past week, UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien was quoted as saying Yemen's cholera outbreak was a man-made catastrophe caused by Yemen's warring sides and their international backers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Muslim communities in Britain are calling for authorities to do more to tackle violence by right-wing extremists following Monday's attack outside London's Finsbury Park Mosque. One person died and at least 11 were injured when the suspect, a 47-year-old white man, drove his vehicle into a crowd of worshippers. Henry Ridgewell reports from the British capital.
The suspect in the London mosque attack reportedly shouted, "Kill all Muslims," as he drove his van into the crowd. Just 2 days earlier, at the same mosque, activist Fayaz Mughal warned of the dangers of attacks.
I think the government have been slow in seeing the threat that is also emanating from some of those sources, which repeatedly daily pump out anti-Muslim rhetoric, which in a way creates the environment for the potential for violence.
Mughal founded the organisation Tell Mama, which collates and reports attacks on Muslims. It says anti-Muslim hate crimes, including physical violence, have increased fivefold since the Islamist terror attack in Manchester last month.
It has social impacts, it certainly has mental health and emotional impacts, and it creates this them and us thinking, which is particularly problematic and in some cases dangerous because extremists play on that.
The London mosque attack came almost exactly a year after a terrorist with extreme right views killed British lawmaker Joe Cox. Media reports say the number of right-wing extremists flagged to the government's anti-terror prevent programme has risen 30%. Terror expert Paul Jackson spoke to VOA via Skype.
Especially the prevent agenda in the UK is very focused on tackling Islamist extremism and is using that as a way to tackle the far right and the extreme right and the issues that it poses, I think still needs to be looked at.
Critics blame conservative media and politicians for stoking up tensions against Muslim communities.
My sense is that there's got to be some sort of relationship between wider mainstream perspectives that seem to be normalising very extreme attitudes towards Muslim people.
The opposition Labour Party has called for an overhaul of the government's prevent programme. The government insists it is committed to tackling all forms of terror. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. Gunshot wounds, car accidents, postpartum hemorrhaging. There are many reasons someone might need a blood transfusion. Hospitals have stored blood on hand for this eventuality. But what about someone who is deep in the countryside or tundra or at sea and needs blood? There's no hospital, no blood bank. So a Pacific Northwest Blood Network is developing a backpack kit that they say takes the banking out of blood banking. Tom Bonse reports.
A blood transfusion can often mean the difference between life and death. In areas far from hospitals and blood banks, like battlefields, medics have trained to do a procedure sometimes called a buddy transfusion. They rapidly collect and transfuse blood after making a match between donor and patient on scene. Now the technique is bleeding over into the civilian world, where it could potentially save tens of thousands of lives every year.
The military was indeed our prototype model for thinking about how to implement a walking blood bank.
Linda Barnes is the chief operating officer at Bloodworks Northwest in Seattle.
Blood banking of stored blood certainly isn't going to go away anytime soon. But in low-resource settings, having banked blood available and the logistics and the refrigeration required simply isn't feasible in the near term.
Barnes has done a lot of international consulting about strengthening blood systems in places such as Ivory Coast, Kenya, Ukraine, and the Caribbean islands. One thing from those trips that nagged at her was how many patients in the developing world die each year for lack of blood, especially women giving birth. Nearly 100,000 new mothers perish from profuse bleeding after childbirth each year. Barnes and a colleague challenged themselves to build a simple, self-contained blood transfusion kit in a shoebox.
So I'm opening it up now so you can see inside.
They came up with the blood pack. The prototype, using off-the-shelf components, morphed into backpack size.
So we have a donor blood collection system. We have a blood typing and disease testing test kits.
This is like a mini lab here.
It is.
No refrigeration needed for any of this because the blood goes from donor to recipient in minutes. The blood pack comes with step-by-step guidance on an app that clinic workers can install on their smartphones. The app could also be used to send a mass text to registered villagers to come to their clinic to give blood in an emergency, in theory.
Because it's one thing, of course, to have an idea, and it's another thing to translate it into a practice.
Recently, BloodWorks Northwest demonstrated their prototype to another potential customer, a Seattle company called Remote Medical International. The fast-growing company supplies medical personnel and support for isolated workplaces. Clinical Operations Director Laureen Locke foresees a variety of applications in oil and gas exploration, for example, or mining, construction, and by military contractors. One thing she brought up was informed consent and the advanced legwork that might be needed to deploy this in a civilian setting.
Part of the discussion evolved into how to do that in a developing world where there's social concerns, religious concerns. What does the local medicine man, if you will, think of the whole concept? Are they willing to sign off on it or not?
Although it's not their primary market, Locke says there's undoubtedly great need in sub-Saharan Africa for a portable blood transfusion kit to address postpartum hemorrhaging.
But then the challenge is there a market there? And there's a difference in that, because can those clinics afford to buy the pack, or would it be donors who are, you know, like foundations, if you will, right? Charities that are purchasing for them.
BloodWorks Northwest just learned they're in line for a roughly $500,000 grant from the British Foreign Aid Department that will launch the next phase of product development, feasibility and acceptability testing at 4 rural clinics in western Kenya, beginning early next year. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump has signed a directive charting a new course in U.S. relations with Cuba. Citing the continuing repression of the Cuban people by the Castro regime, President Trump imposed new restrictions on U.S. travel to and business with Cuba, thereby reversing parts of an executive order by the Obama administration aimed at easing relations with the Cuban government. In a speech in Miami, Florida, announcing the shift in policy, President Trump declared that the previous administration's easing of restrictions on travel and trade does not help the Cuban people. They only enrich the Cuban regime.
The profits from investment and tourism flow directly to the military. The regime takes the money and owns the industry. The outcome of last administration's executive action has been only more repression and a move to crush the peaceful democratic movement.
The new U.S. policy channels economic activities away from the Cuban military while allowing American individuals and entities to develop economic ties to the private small business sector in Cuba. It makes clear that the primary obstacle to the Cuban people's prosperity and economic freedom is a stifling, state-controlled economic system, including the Cuban military's extensive presence throughout the Cuban economy. The policy also enhances travel restrictions to better enforce the statutory ban on U.S. tourism to Cuba. Among other changes, travel for non-academic educational purposes will be limited to group travel. In addition, the new directive reaffirms the U.S. embargo on Cuba. President Trump declared, "We will not lift sanctions until all political prisoners are freed, freedoms of assembly and expression are respected, all political parties are legalized, and free and internationally supervised elections are scheduled." The United States Embassy will remain open, said President Trump, in the hope that our countries can forge a much stronger and better path. When Cuba is ready to take concrete steps, we will be ready, willing, and able to come to the table to negotiate that much better a deal for Cubans, for Americans. The United States, declared Mr. Trump, believes that free, independent, and sovereign nations are the best vehicle for human happiness. At the same time, he added, we all accept that all nations have the right to chart their own paths, so we will respect Cuban sovereignty. But we will never turn our backs on the Cuban people. That will not happen.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.